Welcome to Innovation and Leadership. I'm Jess Larson. On this episode, we get to have Joe Shalaby, CEO at eMortgage Capital. Joe, thanks for making time for this.
Absolutely. Thank you.
So can you start by giving people a little bit of a scope of just how successful you guys have become?
Absolutely. So eMortgage Capital, we're the number one non-delegated mortgage banker in the country currently. We have over 900 independent loan officers. Independent by what that means is these are independent loan agents that basically run their own business, leveraging our ecosystem, our platform nationwide. So we're in about 37 states. We have we are adding the rest of the country this in the next couple quarters. So we should be in actually except New York. We're going to be in 49 of the 50 states here in the next couple quarters. We are looking to add probably another 1,000 loan officers in the next three quarters. So we are growing at a massive scale right now, at a massive pace, and our platform is bar none the best in class, the best in the industry when it comes to providing resources, marketing, technology, different innovations. We're a plug and play solution for anyone, whether you're a mortgage broker, you own your own mortgage company, or you're a mortgage banker, to duplicate a platform like ours at the scale and scope and size with the amount of resources. Basically, you know, unless you start with a hedge fund, it's almost impossible to duplicate the type of resources. But even if you had a private equity starting your mortgage company, you wouldn't be able to, have the same amount of resources we've had, because we've been in the weeds, kind of, you know, doing all the trial and error and figuring out what works, what marketing strategies work, what platforms work, what data works, what cadences when it comes to automation works. So it's really not something you could just get private equity and do, because you have to be really in the weeds of your business and setting up a business for others to succeed. And that's really our platform, is we are in the business of making businesses.
Yeah. And do you guys disclose any numbers like revenue or volume or anything like that?
So, I mean, our revenue is public record from what I see when I Google it. It's like you can pull our revenue. Now, we're not publicly traded. We don't have private equity. Will we entertain that? I mean, we are tightening things up so that, you know, we don't have any plans to ever exit, but we are just, you know, keeping those numbers now more at the forefront just so we can tighten up our systems. You know, building out our Salesforce integrations, building out our different CRMs to integrate into Salesforce, building out all of the back end that really goes into the true value of a company, because front end stuff is, you know, it's very fleeting when it comes to a mortgage company, whereas the back end operations and licensing and our HUD delegation, our Fannie licensing, or all this stuff when it comes to being an actual banker, that's really the true value. So we are starting to, our gross revenue, it's public, you know, it's a Google search.
What's the number of people would see if they did a Google search?
I think last year we did 100 million gross revenue or something like that. We do a couple hundred. In 2021 and 2020, we had a couple hundred million gross revenue, right? So, now, net revenue is different. I wish that was net, but the gross is significant because, again, we're paying out hundreds of people. So we'll continue to pay out hundreds of people. I want to also note that, we're continuing to scale at such a fast pace right now that gross revenue is just going to get much, much bigger even this year, just because we've added some massive partnerships. And now my strategy as a whole, as a CEO, has totally changed. I just exited being the official recruiter per se, and I'm no longer recruiting. I just did that in the last couple months. Now what I do full time is I'm in the business now of just basically branding the company, becoming more of the brand authority, being more of a thought leader, just influencing the big producers in the industry so that, you know, top top companies, top mortgage bankers nationwide, when they look up who's steering the ship at the top level, they go, oh, I really like what Joe Shalaby's doing. When they're electing, because there's only five of us mega companies nationwide. But now when people are selecting which route they're going to go, they want to see who's actually at on the top, giving them the proper direction, the proper guidance, and making sure that, you know, I'm always in their best interest, innovating at the speed of light, always innovating and driving those innovations to help these guys succeed, and also staying at the top of, you know, the hyper compliance that continues just to, you know, throw curveballs at these people's success. Also, a lot of AI is starting to really disrupt what loan officers were doing. So, you know, what one loan officer was doing, you know, 2 years ago, or what 20 loan officers were doing 2 years ago, one loan officer could do now with all of the automation and the AI and the capabilities that are in place now. So a lot of people have exited the space, have found that, you know, that loan officer who's working with eMortgage has already eaten their lunch. And it's unfortunate for many who exited thinking that it's the same old, because that was the normal thing. And to, you know, basically throughout mortgage history, is you could leave the space and come back when the rates drop and leave the space and come back when the rates drop. That's no longer the case now. You leave the space, you've left the industry for good, because it's hard to just come dive back in to the space and, you know, get caught up with what big companies like ours are doing.
Yeah. Speaking of becoming the thought leader, you've got your own podcast, Coffees and Closers.
Coffees with a Z.
So CEOs today who are thinking about having their own show, you know, and they might say, like, you're in a company that does, you know, between 100 and 200 million a year, what, you know, how do you have time for a podcaster? What's the benefits of a podcaster? What would be your sales pitch for why a top CEO might want their own show?
Well, I mean, it's totally changed now. Like, now, I'll be honest, like, CEOs who are holding on to certain roles, whether it's business development or you know, different marketing, or I even, like, sometimes, you know, do loans for friends and family, like, that stuff kind of bogs you down. But the podcast and the social strategy and all of the media influence that I'm really kind of going after is more macro style, a more macro style approach, where I know that leaders in my industry are looking to be led by thought leaders, right? So if you're a CEO and you are still, you know, really in the weeds of day to day, it's really hard to attract top talent. So part of the business development strategy that I realized in the last couple months was, like, great talent is looking at who's steering the ship. They want to know, you know, that whoever's steering the ship is on the cusp of whatever and has great relationships and established great rapport with other leaders of industry. And they want to know that, you know, like, for instance, even my podcast, I bring on my competitors. My last podcast, I literally called it Clash of the Titans, because people were like, why is he going to interview the guy who we think they're enemies? You know, they think that we want to kill each other. But at the end of the day, we're friends. Like, there's only a few of us at the very top, and I'm trying to maintain diplomacy with all of them. And if you ask all the top leaders, like, you know, who's their favorite of all of them, like, I can call all of them, I can have them on my show, I can make deeper relationships. And what I've found is that I have the same problems and we all share the same issues. And it's an easy collaborative effort when we have the same problems, especially when it comes to, like, we're all dealing with macro problems, like with regulators and the CFPB and compliance and different state regulators. And, you know, we all need to be on the same page with that stuff. So what I found is it's presented. It's like your own independent YPO with the leaders that you pick, you know. So you're like, I want to talk to this guy or that guy. It's like, you know, so it's its own, what it's created, its own community for me. And more importantly, what it's done is the relationships that it creates with other thought leaders within different industries. Now, I'm obviously targeting people within the mortgage industry and other verticals, real estate space, but I'm also starting to look at other CEOs within other industries, because we all share the same problems. And I know YPO is going to give me the same kind of benefit, but this allowed me to go even deeper than a traditional leadership organization, and it's on my time, and it's directly for the benefit of what I'm trying to accomplish, which is reaching massive audiences. And you know, one thing that I've always been really good at as a CEO is I consider myself a very good marketer, and I try to leverage different marketing solutions, you know, on every platform. So I have a really good omnipresent platform. So, you know, I'm trying to be everywhere all the time, all at once, on every platform, on every vertical. And whether it's, you know, print, whether it's, you know, digital, whether it's social, whether it's podcast, wherever it is, like, and if it's reaching people, I want to be there. So, you know, if another CEO is saying, oh, a podcast is going to be a waste of my time, that's not the case. Matter of fact, other CEOs now are going to realize in my space, after they see the success of what this podcast has brought us in such a short period. I mean, we launched 2 months ago, and it's already reaching tons of people. And I already have talked to other mortgage professionals that are following it, and a ton of mortgage professionals have joined our organization because of it. So, you know, I know for a fact it's working. So what I'm looking at this as is, like, this has turned into, you know, somewhat of my job, because now I can influence people at a much greater pace, and I can reach people a lot faster. So if CEOs are reluctant, now I'm not going to tell you it's easy, because we've spent a lot of time building out our podcast room. We've spent a lot of time figuring out the strategy, and every single day we're discovering some way to improve the podcast marketing, the podcast editing, the podcast reach, the way, various ways to leverage different clips of the pod. I mean, it's just an ever-growing ever-growing, almost sub-business for us. That's literally I'm just investing in right now, but the intangible value that it's created for us has been, so far, in my opinion, I think priceless.
Yeah, I would echo that for our companies. What it's done for us. I think about it as, like, what's the highest leverage activities CEOs can do, where, like, they work once, but it affects so many people. And, like, I even think about, like, we had clients at Bloomberg talk about, like, they thought it was mostly going to be helpful for their clients, but then they started hearing back from their own staff of, like, oh, I didn't even realize we were doing that. Like, their own staff were finding out stuff about the company, and, like, it was motivation. It was keeping everybody just a little bit more excited about coming to work. And you think about, like, there's so few things that will duplicate your time so much as almost like becoming your own media company, right? Like, we have at Greystoke Networks, we have all these clients, you know, big CEOs that are like, they're paying 15, 20 grand a month for PR anyways. And it's like, it's almost like skipping the gatekeeper and becoming your own PR, right?
You know, that's a good point. PR, like, if you're going to be like in PR on like Forbes or Variety, there's value to that. But like creating your own podcast is good, and then reaching the people that you thought you would never reach. Like, because you could be in a Forbes magazine and you have no idea what that did, and that cost you 12, 15 grand. Whereas the podcast, you know directly. You got, number one off the bat, every relationship I've made through the podcast isn't like, I can call these people, they're friends. I had really deep, meaningful conversations with them, and now we're friends forever. And our conversation is going to live for eternity, which is like, you know, how do you quantify the value of that? And then, you know, now I'm tapping into their networks, and it's like, I know there's different PR, and I've worked with PR companies before, and, you know, you don't know what you're going to get with those guys. You just don't know. Yeah. You know, some of them could be a total coax, and some of them are like, they deliver on what they say. But this is like a definite. But if there's.
Yeah. I think about that exact scenario, and it's like, instead of paying for PR, because I've had PR people get me into Forbes and stuff, right? And it's like, I'm paying for PR to get me into Forbes so that all these people will read it, most of whom have no possible way of becoming a client or connection, hoping that like this, you know, I can get like at least one like really highly placed, hard to reach decision maker that now wants to contact me because they saw the Forbes thing, right? And it's like with the podcast, you like skip all that and just that one person I hope would read the Forbes and contact me. We just put them right on the show and like skip the whole process.
Exactly, exactly. And you're hoping with that. To your point right now, you said you're just going to be hoping that someone is going to, you know, reach out to you. And the probability of that happening is like next to impossible anyways.
Actually, with my Forbes placement, I got zero out of it, actually. Whereas the podcast, I'm guaranteed that person, right? Because what did we book it for? Like, of course, I want to hang out with people like you who businesses are fluctuating between 100 and 200 million a year, right? Like, this way, I guarantee you that I get to hang out with you. Let's shift gears, though. I'm interested in, you know, what advantages you think you've had as an entrepreneur being raised by an immigrant father from Egypt?
Well, it wasn't just being raised by an immigrant father. I myself am an immigrant. I immigrated from Egypt at the age of 5. So, you know, I'll be fully transparent. When I came from Egypt, I was, you know, we came from a third world country, but it wasn't just a normal third world country. We were from the poor part of the third world country. I joke and I say I'm really from a sixth world country. Having an immigrant mindset when I came to America and applying it to business, and it still sticks with me till this very moment, every single day, every time I go to get a cup of coffee, every time I go to, you know, buy food out, I'm always looking for ways to optimize my cost. And, you know, whether it's my vendors, whether it's relationships, whether it's the partnerships I've created with my investors, like, I'm getting the best deal everywhere I go. And I've been notorious since I was a kid going through like the bazaar and negotiating costs as like a 14-year-old. I remember vividly, you know, like I take my kids to the fairgrounds, swap meet, and I teach them that trait. Unfortunately, I can't make them come from a third world, but I could definitely teach them, you know, the art of negotiation and how crucial that is for your success, because, you know, having a poverty-stricken mindset for me has been one of the reasons why I've been as successful as I am. You know, coming from an immigrant family where, you know, I worked my tail off for months to get like a Street Fighter II game. Yeah, you know, it's like things didn't ever come easy. I remember when I was 8 years old, and I lost $7. And I was like so bummed about that, you know, because we didn't have much money. So, you know, I still remember it. You know, I still remember how hard things came to us, even though now we're talking about millions and hundreds of millions and or whatever it is. Like, money is not the game for me. You know, it's not. It's never been. It's always been a byproduct of my hard work, my success, my perseverance, and my ability to always provide value. If you ask, I've taken a couple of my partnerships with my vendors where I've helped scale them so much that they were able to sell to private equity, you know, and it's happened to a few of my vendors, right? And it's because of I've been able to put them on the map, introduce them to big other big partners. And I look at it like, I didn't get any money for that. They got tens of millions, I got nothing, but guess what? I got a lifelong partnership with people that will go above and beyond to make sure that, you know, they help me out. So
that's amazing. Well, I have had so many inspirational immigrants and children of immigrants on the show. I mean, I think in America, you're 4 times more likely to become a millionaire if you're an immigrant or a child of an immigrant. There is such an entrepreneurial trait for these brave people willing to pick up and move to an entire new country and deal with the unknown and cultural and possibly language barriers and all these kind of things. I want to hear one thing you admire about your mom, one thing you admire about your dad.
You know, my dad, like helped you. My mom and dad. So I'll talk about my dad for a second because he, and I had my competitor, my number one competitor in my business is very similar. He comes from the same exact background, same. He's also Egyptian, but he didn't immigrant. He wasn't an immigrant like me, but you know, his dad was. But both of our dads are still physicians and still working. And my dad works every single day. He just turned 74. He works 5 days a week, sometimes six. And he does it with a passion. He doesn't need to work, but he loves what he does. He loves serving his patients. He loves making sure that people are taken care of. He loves making sure that his family's taken care of. And he's always maintained like this really hard, regardless of whatever happens, I'm showing up to work. The only times he misses work is when he's like really sick. Like there is no excuse to miss work. Even if he's sick, he goes to work. But he's got to be really sick to not show up to work. And for me, like to see somebody that, you know, it goes against the grain at all costs, is always willing to grind. You know, when I think, oh, I don't want to work, or I want to stay lazy or whatever. And I go, my dad's still grinding every single day. He's not out playing golf. He's not like messing around. Matter of fact, most of billionaires I know are still, you know, they're some of the hardest working people. They don't stop. And they're not out on the golf course. They're not.
And
just like,
I think that can sound depressing to people who don't love their work. But I know exactly what you're talking about, where people that have embraced what they do. Like, work is actually fun. It's like their favorite sport, right?
It is. Now think about me. I'm now in a position where all I have to do is influence masses. Like, how fun is that? I do podcasts. I go viral on social media. I do, you know, whatever. You know, I just have to just get in front of tens of millions of people. And, you know, when I was young, I was like an actor, you know, and I would do improv performances or whatever, traveling improv or different performances. And I loved it. Like, I was influencing people and making them laugh. And now I'm doing the same thing. You know, I'm providing value in an entertaining format. And I'm influencing people. The difference is now that I'm influencing them, but I'm using creativity to draw them to come to our organization. And it's awesome. I mean, I continue to always redefine my passion within work. So the monotony of it, you know, it's never monotonous, right? Even when I was recruiting, or even when I was the top originator in the country, one of the top originators in the country, like, it's always been fun. Because helping people get into homes is fun for me. Like, I really love seeing them accomplish their dream with home ownership or getting out of debt or whatever it is. And then when I was recruiting, bringing them over to the organization and showing them a better way, that things are better on this side in the independent channel. And now, like, with the next, this is a whole new venture for me to become like to work on thought leadership as a strategy to grow the organization. I didn't even know that that was a possibility. And now seeing the opportunity that that's presenting has been just incredible for me.
Yeah. So we can shift gears again. I want to hear this idea of being able to attract, you know, 900 loan officers so far, shooting for another 1,000 this year. What's a secret or what's a tip to that that maybe people from outside wouldn't understand or wouldn't naturally know?
So here's the thing. I mean, candidly, like, I have to always bring so much value to people, because to grow an organization at scale, especially when you're trying to bring in top talent, you have to bring so much value to them. And I'm willing to do things that nobody else is willing to do. And I'll give you a quick instance. Like, I'm willing to make $0 for however many years to come so that I can provide enough data and marketing and technology and lead generation and different systems in place so that people who work for the organization can grow abundantly every single year without, you know, when I got into this business, I was worried about the guy, the broker in 2002, because this business wasn't very regulated, who would just up and take my commissions. Like, I was like, I didn't even understand how that was possible. So there was a huge lack of honesty and integrity in the industry for years, up until Dodd-Frank hit, and then it became a regulated business. So what inspired me now, like, people are totally shielded now from well, not fully from that, but with our company, like we really pride ourselves on having a lot of integrity, being willing to work with the loan officer, being at their beck and call. Like I respond to everybody. I'm at everyone's service. Like I'm always willing to help everybody personally, meet with them and help them grow. But you know, the biggest thing to attract top talent is you have to be able to provide tons of value. And providing tons of value isn't like I'm just saying I'm providing tons of value. It's like, you know, I'm hosting trainings. I got mortgage coaches. I got, you know, provide data. I whatever it is, you know, like lead generation strategies or, you know, people think I'm crazy because of what I do. They're like, they don't understand. They're like, why would you spend all that money? And why are you willing to, you know, give up everything? Because I see that in 2025 or 2026, I'm going to have so much market share that the money right now doesn't matter. Plus, I have more money than I ever wanted to have anyways. I never wanted to be like, you know, this really super wealthy guy. And I'm not saying I'm super wealthy, but that's never been on my agenda. What's been on my agenda is to be of service, to do God's work, to be a man of God, to be a man of honor, and to always put the people that I serve way above my needs.
I mean, solid fundamentals. I want to go back to this idea of investing and you know, thinking ahead to the future and innovating. Can you explain more about how AI is changing the mortgage business and what you said, like a broker with AI?
Well, it's allowing AI to really, because it's allowing us to get in front of tons of people without having all these people. You know, like I don't need a lot of loan officers. I can have one loan officer just managing all of the outreach that the AI is doing, right? And then, you know, we're automating the quote process. We're automating the data process. We're automating every single process associated with the outreach. I mean, everything, you know, where 20 people were needed before, you don't need them anymore. You know, it's like every part of the industry is continually getting refined with AI. So, yeah. So what used to take 30 days, now it takes 7. What used to take 10 people, now it takes 1 or 2. And that gap is continuing to close, which I like that because now I'm able to do so much more with way less people. And we try to do a pretty good job with basically getting people out of the industry that shouldn't really be in the industry, because you got a lot of LOs who are just kind of holding on to this hope that rates go back down to 2.5% or 3%. The reality, when maybe Trump gets elected or whoever gets elected, I don't know whoever gets elected, by the next election season, people are hoping for a rate downturn. But let's face the reality, that's we're never going to see rates like we saw in the pandemic. It's impossible. It would just totally destroy society. We're going to be around the 6-7% range for, I think this is where we need to be for years to come. Even when we do see a Fed rate cut, which we haven't seen, but they said they're going to do in the next couple quarters, but no data has indicated that we're ready for a rate cut. And I don't think we're going to get much data to indicate we're ready for a rate cut. Even if we are ready for a rate cut, I don't think mortgage rates will really go down very much.
Yeah.
Just because we're booming still as an economy with high rates.
Yeah. You know, I'm thinking about, so I'm lucky. My one business partner is my brother, very technical. And, you know, we actually changed his title to like chief AI officer because he's just like, can't get enough of it. And like, for him, it's like, he loves it. It's like a sport. It's like, oh, how can I get rid of the rest of the stuff so I can go back to doing AI? And he keeps doing like, AI that feeds to an automation that feeds back to an AI that feeds to an automation. And, you know, about every other week, it seems like we get some new version of something that he's invented for us. And as we hire staff who've like been in our industry before, they're like, wow, I can't believe like how much you guys get done. Like, this is so different because everything's so automated. I don't have to do everything. But I'm interested in like what that looks like granularly. Like, do you have people on staff? Are you working with contractors as you build out these AIs or decide which AI vendors to use? What does that decision tree look like for you?
So the decision tree, candidly, it's all like, for the most part, I have several vendors. I'm always kind of, I'm personally in the weeds with interviewing vendors. And then I have internal team just implementing. So, you know, I'm not going to hire people that are like AI experts. I'm going to reach out to people that I know that like come from a reputable source that I can work with, you know, because it's such a new field and everybody says this or that. And you just don't have any assurance that, you know, whoever you're going to hire is going to be the candidate. So I personally feel that working with vendors who are offering services and just doing split tests is the way to go because it's just such a new field. And saying that you're an expert to me right now is just, it's just too new to be a true expert. Like, how are you an expert? Like, I don't know, is Sam Altman even an expert? You know, like, is he? I don't know. Like, he invented, you know, OpenAI, but like, it's so brand new. Like, who's truly an expert?
Well, and who's an expert on the thing that will get invented next week, right?
Exactly.
Stuff keeps coming out all the time.
Expert on ChatGPT-4. Well, there's no experts on ChatGPT-5 because it's not out, but it's coming out in, you know, a week. Who knows?
Yeah. So I'm interested. What are the kind of questions you're asking, or what are some of the ways that you use to find the vendor that you actually have faith in?
So for us, like, AI is used in, so we haven't found a conversational AI tool. I've invested, I've worked with vendors, and we haven't got any conversational AI that's been able to work yet. And we've already spent a bunch of money. So we've reached out to AI companies, and the integration of conversational AI into these different platforms is just what we're seeing is just not there yet. I'm thinking like we're on the cusp. I think conversational AI for us is coming in the next couple quarters. But it's mostly like, you know, marketing companies that have implemented AI that we have use cases for that they can show us that, hey, I've been able to generate this amount of business using these. And it's like text AI or voicemail AI or video AI, but conversational AI where it's going to, I rolled out another AI that's basically like me. It's my doppelganger, right? And I just basically input what, like, let's say I wanted to talk about trending topics today. And I'll just put in like, you know, when's the next Fed rate cut or whatever. And then the AI will feed into ChatGPT. And then I can go on as me and talk for 5 minutes about whatever it is, you know, and I just put in my words and it's just me going like this and just talking for 5-10 minutes. So we have different variances of AI. Matter of fact, I talked to one of my AI companies now, they're rolling out like a video editing solution within the AI framework. So, you know, I'm talking to different AI companies. I'm vetting them. I'm vetting their work. But I'm talking to the CEOs and I'm talking about their vision. Like, what do you envision this being? Is this going to be conversational? Is it going to be reactive? Is this going to be texting? Is this going to be video? Is this just going to be, you know? So I dive deep into what the CEO's vision is. And I was supposed to do a demo today on the platform I'm already using. He's like, let's hold off because our video editing solution is going to be ready in about 3-4 days. Like, so this stuff is literally progressing in real time. In real time. So I don't even know what it's going to look like in a month, you know? But when you talk to the CEO and their vision and their game plan and their roadmap in 2024, you have to really dial in what's your roadmap and what do you expect this platform to do this year? Because you're signing up you're in beta. All this stuff is all beta.
Yeah.
And what you're doing with your brother, beta, you know, it's all beta. It's going to change next week.
Yeah. Yeah. It's almost like for us, we think about it as much as like, oh, great, we've got a new tool or, you know, like he learned how to code SQL databases and we've been building a new tool that feeds into them and pulls out of them. And just because we deal with so many, you know, so many contacts across our clients and all our clients' guests and all my guests, right? But it's almost like the state of continuous learning. Instead of like thinking you're ever going to be done, you know, it's like nobody ever played basketball and was like, as a pro, is like, okay, I'm just going to win this one game and then I'll be good forever. No, the season goes on. Like every
you play, you every get week, better
there's
every
the next
game.
Set of games, right?
It's funny you talk about basketball. I still play basketball, so I'm still in a league, and I'm going to use basketball as an example. But if you look at the greats, you know, I my friend bought the Phoenix Suns, so I know like how, and he tells me about Kevin Durant. But Kevin Durant shows up 1 hour before every other player, and he stays after the game if he loses or wins. Same with Kobe Bryant when he played, he showed up 2 hours before everyone was practicing, you know. So he showed up 2 hours before practice, and he, you know, so the greats put in so much extra work. Cherokee Parks, I had him on a show, or, you know, we didn't actually record because he was nervous, but he came into the studio, and he was saying that, you know, when he was he played on the Clippers, but, you know, he would tell us about, you know, Blake Griffin or all these guys were like Chris Paul or the guys he played with, right? These guys outworked everybody. They just outworked everybody. They were there. They put in so much more work than the average player in the NBA. They weren't out partying. They weren't out, you know, messing around. Like, they were the ones doing all the work. Then there, the day before, the night before, the day of, you know. So it's the work ethic of the elites, of the most successful, is another level. I'm going to use my mentor, you know, up until he bought the Phoenix Suns, he was at the office at 4 a.m. every day, and he would leave at 6. Now he gets in the office late, 6 a.m., because he's up late with because he's on the East, and he's working on West Coast time. So, you know, the reality is the greats always outwork everyone. But they don't – work ethic is just one piece of success, as we all know. You know, it's work ethic. It's innovating. It's the ability to collaborate. And what I like to say, it's like always staying or trying to stay as humble as you possibly can and reminding yourself, you know, that you're just dust.
Yeah. I'm interested when you think about another principle for, you know, for those of us who have not grown their business over $100 million a year revenue, what's another principle that you would share?
I mean, one of the things that I'm always working on this, it's, you know, it's, again, it's don't ever chase the money. Success always, money always follows your success. So if you are one thing I always focused on is always being hyper focused on my loan officers being successful. And so my loan officers are effectively my clients. So if you're just hyper-focused on their success, the success for your company will follow. So, you know, always worry about the customer. Always worry about your client. Never worry about yourself. Like, how are you going to make ends meet? Ends meet will always come. But extreme laser focus on the customer experience and on the customer's well-being, that's a true way to show that you're gonna be able to be successful because you're delivering a successful experience to those that you're serving. We have five pillars at our company, and our number one pillar is serve. Serve your clients with all your heart, with all your mind, all your soul. Serve your vendor partners, serve your lender partners, and serve one another within the organization with all your heart, all your might, all your soul. That's our number one company pillar. Our second company pillar is community. So we look at the eMortgage Capital organization, there's 900 of us, right? As one big community. Like there's a few associations within the mortgage world, but eMortgage Capital is its own independent association. But this association is, you know, so much more special than the traditional mortgage association because everyone is like-minded, works for the same company, has the same leadership, and has the same vision. And when you reach out to somebody at eMortgage Capital, like, and we always ingrain this in everybody's mind, it's like they're immediately helping. Everyone at eMortgage Capital is helping each other. They're collaborating with each other. They're innovating together. They're really trying to build and foster a true relationship, which is our third pillar. Relationships are imperative for growth within our organization. So I tell everybody within the company, like, build relationships with each other. So we have many ways to build relationships with each other within the company. We have, you know, daily meetings. We that are like training and coaching, etc. We have quarterly summits that we do. We have month-end parties that we host at our company. We have an annual conference. We have different workshops. So, like, and then we have daily exchanges on Microsoft Teams in a sales channel where people are posting scenarios or ways to get help. So we're really encouraging a culture of collaboration and fostering relationships. So, you know, between serving, community, relationships, and our fourth pillar, it's being ever forward. And we always maintain and embrace a culture of like dynamic change, especially in this environment. So as long as we're staying ever forward, always remaining open-minded to the latest and greatest in innovation, resources, technology, data, marketing, you know, we're going to be an unstoppable team. And the last thing we like to say is we're all thumb pointers here. So, you know, if we're not doing all four that our fifth pillar thumb points, we're not doing serving. If we're not building a community, if we're not building relationships, if we're not always being ever forward and we're not being accountable, you know, it's our fault. Like, it's our fault we don't succeed. It's our fault that, you know, we didn't grow. It's our fault that we failed. It's our fault that we had to exit the space because we didn't put in the work. We didn't build the relationships. We didn't serve our clients. We're, you know, self-centered. Then, you know, there's only so much me as a leader I can do. I say this to my people all the time. It's like, I'm going to lead all of you to the water. I'm going to give you all the resources for success. I'm going to give you my playbook. You're not going to have to go through the suffering that I went through. You're not going to have to figure out the marketing. You're not going to have to figure out the technology. You're not going to have to figure out the data. You're not going to have to figure out what to say, the scripting. You're not going to have to do any of the things that I had to do. I'm going to lead you to the water. I'm going to put your face in the water. I'm going to try to drown you in the water. And you know what I cannot do? I cannot make you drink the water. I cannot do it until AI does it. And AI is going to do it. It's going to drink your water soon. So people are going to have to get on that bandwagon now, or AI is going to drink their water. And, you know, obviously we're trying to solve for that always, because we just have to. We have no choice but to lead in innovation. And, you know, sadly or fortunately, AI is leading us to that. And we don't want AI to take people's jobs, but it's just going to really shrink the market. And I think that's a good thing, because we're going to have less people and things are going to get a lot cheaper in the mortgage space as a result.
You know, there's a great economist named Paul Pilser that talks about that, and how when we create efficiencies like AI, there can be short-term pain while people get reskilled to a new job or something, right? But you're actually growing the economy, because if all of the loans that need to get made still get made, but now we have more people available to go invent new companies and go do more services, but we're still getting the original thing done, we've actually grown the economy on a whole. And so now there's actually more money to go around because of the new values they can add over here without having lost the value of now those loans aren't getting made. And it's a bumpy road. And I'm not saying that there's no pain involved, but the net benefit overall is pretty clear.
I mean, to that point, and I'm going to use myself as a real life use case, like, I was the only guy doing all the recruiting for the company. And as soon as I was able to relinquish that from my fingertips, I was able to open up my creativity and add the podcast. I was able to add like the viral content. I was able to really strategize. So to your point, to that economist, what was the economist's name?
Paul Pilser.
To Paul Pilser's point, like, as soon as you're able to get outside of your, you know, your normal to do, like your comfort zone, and get uncomfortable with expanding your reach, expanding your ideas, expanding your philosophies, like, you're going to grow. Like, I just like what I did with this, like with adding this podcast and doing these shows and getting out in the media, like, it's the same thing, but I did it more at a macro level, but it's going to apply at the micro level with anyone who's, you know, whether it's my loan officers, now they don't have to go out and hunt for loans all day long. Like, the loans are coming to them. Now they got to serve their clients. Now they got to go do presentations or whatever it is. Now they got to go out into, you know, to realtor offices and educate, or whatever the concept is. you know, that theory does apply, but it only applies to people who take action. Now, the reality is in our society and what we're suffering from is that there is an extreme lack of taking action and people who are doers. And, you know, it's sad to say, but we are raising an economy, you know, many youth now are just being raised in a, you know, in a very entitled society, you know, a society where they just think everything's going to be handed to them or the government's just going to, you know, fill the gap for them. And that's, you know, that's something that, you know, hopefully we ward off, or that theory, you know, that the government's giving so much assistance to those that don't want to take action, dissipates. I don't know when, I don't know if it's going to dissipate, but at least that's something that, you know, those listening to the podcast, you and me, we can do for our children.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. Well, I know we're kind of winding down here. Before we let you go, can we get one more $100 million a year success secret?
Let's see. One of my favorite things is like, we have to focus on the things that are most important. And for me, like, and for many people listening, like, it's your why should be like your family or your faith. Like, I'm a man of faith. One of the things that I think is my main secret to success is I seek God's help for everything. You know, you see behind me, I got icons. I'm Coptic Orthodox Christian, so I've always been defined by my faith. When I came and immigrated to the U.S., like, faith has been the pillar for me of my success. I always seek God's counsel for, you know, whatever big decisions or small decisions. You know, so a huge, huge thing to take off. Don't put it, it's not in your hands. Everything is fleeting in this world. So be faithful, be resilient, seek God's help for everything in your decision making, and he'll provide you wise counsel. And that counsel, if it comes from above, then it's meant to be.
That's great. Speaking of wise counsel, do you have any favorite books?
Let's see. I mean, I really like Ryan Holiday's book, Ego is the Enemy, because and I can give it a read or listen like frequently, just because it's a, even though he is a young guy, I don't even know how he got so wise. And it's not like it's just a book that you can always just kind of remind yourself, you know, how weak we are to our egos, because ego really is the enemy. As you climb these social ladders, these quote unquote social ladders, you really realize like you're really fighting your ego. And it can really disrupt, it can really disrupt your vision and your overall hope for growth. So just a reminder for everyone give that book a read or a listen, like your ego will destroy you.
I love everything that guy has written. His book, The Obstacle is the Way, I listen to part of that book like every week.
Yeah, it's amazing. I don't know how he's so wise at such a young age, but he's incredible.
That's so great.
That's awesome. You love that guy too. That's great.
Yeah, such a fan. Well, listen, if people want to find the podcast, if they want to learn more about you or follow you on social, so, where are the best places?
Coffees, COFFEEZ, Foreclosures. Coffees, Foreclosures. It's on iTunes, Spotify, and YouTube. Follow me on YouTube, Coffees for Closers. Also, Joseph Shalaby on Instagram. Joseph Shalaby on Instagram. And Coffees for Closers on Instagram, TikTok, LinkedIn, Facebook. It's on every platform.
So fun. Well, congrats on all your success.
Absolutely. Jess, it's been an absolute pleasure. And, you know, I look forward to doing this again with you. Thank you so much for having me on. It's a blessing.
So fun. Hey, bye, everyone.